You're listening to episode 16 of season 6 of The GNU World Order. Hi everyone, this is Klaatu and this is The GNU World Order. It's my little show about Linux and Unix and BSD and other geeky things. I know what you're thinking, Klaatu, you never talk about BSD. You talked about BSD like once or twice last season, and you never mentioned it again. Well, today I'm going to mention it again, so I get to say that it is in part about BSD. So today we're going to talk about a couple of different things. One is BSD, how to mount logical volumes. That's not about BSD. Another one about Linux and Unix and our operating system, our collective operating system, and I'll probably mention some other stuff as well, so let's get started. So these past couple of weeks I've been working a lot of different things, really. Some artistic projects, some very geeky projects, and actually this episode itself was going to be about something completely different originally, but it ended up being such a large topic that I didn't really think I'd be able to do it justice quite yet. I want to make sure that I am very clear on all of the technical stuff. So I'm kind of doing a Plan B episode. Not that that makes this episode worth less, it's just that's how it is. So I've been working on a lot of stuff, and one of the random things that I've been working on was migrating some Fedora data, or some data that was stored on a Fedora machine to a new computer. So to do this, I booted up off of a live CD, and I figured I would mount the hard drive from that live environment and do like an rsync to a backup drive, and then I realized that I've never manually mounted a logical volume before, an LVM2 partition. So of course Fedora and Red Hat both use these logical volumes by default, and I know that I've actually missed a couple of presentations on the advantages of logical volumes at various technical conferences, so I'm not 100% sure, unfortunately, why they're so cool, but they exist. Fedora and Red Hat both seem to be quite fond of them. I don't really mess around with them directly that much, but it turns out that dealing with them is not all that intense. It's actually pretty simple if you find yourself booting onto a Red Hat or a Fedora machine and you're staring at this single hard drive or this single logical volume, whereas you are pretty sure there are different partitions and things like that. All you need is a simple tool set for the logical volume management, and of course if you're booting off of Fedora, that would have that on there already. If you're doing another distribution, you might have to go seek out the logical volume tools. But the tool that you start with is VG, as in volume group change, and the flags that you set for that is --AY. So in this case, for instance, it might have been logical group VG_Yorktown would be now activated, meaning that you're activating that logical volume. So you turned it on, you've activated it. Now you can access the stuff in that logical volume. Before we do that, of course, we'd want to make some kind of folder or some place to mount this the partition that we're about to mount. So I just did a make dir /mnt/rescue. You don't really have to make a directory. You could put it into /mnt if you wanted to, but I just liked to put it into its own place. And then you can say mount /dev/VG_Yorktown. And of course, if you didn't know what it was called or you wanted to take a look, you can just do an ls on /dev. But in this case, it told us what the volume was called. And so it's mount /dev/VG_Yorktown /LV_home. And again, you can do an ls on that /dev/vg_Yorktown to find out what partitions, or I guess they're really logical volumes, are present on that volume group. So in this case, there was, I think, an lv home, an lv root, and an lv probably temp or something. I don't exactly remember what logical volumes were present off the top of my head, but if you do an ls on the volume group /dev/volume_group_foo, then you'll get a list of all the different partitions or the logical volumes. I keep using the traditional terminology, meaning the new logical volume terminology. So lv_home, and then I mounted that to /mnt/rescue, and then of course you just cd over into /mnt/rescue, do an ls, and sure enough, there's everything from the home logical volume. In this case, I think there was only one user present on that computer, but if there had been more than one, then yes, you'd now be looking at all of the users' home directories. I mean, obviously, if your layout of the logical volumes is different and you made it unique, then you could see all kinds of different logical volumes there. It just depends. This particular computer had just used the default Fedora scheme. So that's really all there is to it. It's simply activating the volume group, looking inside of the volume group to see what logical volumes there are in there, and then mounting one of those logical volumes to some directory on your system. That's it. So I got a laptop back from someone I had lent it to, and I decided that I was kind of missing BSD. As you may or may not remember or know, at the end of Season 5, which was like 3 years ago now, I was running BSD on a laptop, Toshiba laptop, and I was really enjoying it, actually. Overall, I was very, very impressed. It was a fun system to run. It was really cool to learn new commands, find out different ways of doing things, getting more familiar with like the wheel group. I mean, even though I've used the wheel group before, just kind of getting to know that a lot better. Just weird little things like that. It was fun. Ports, I do like it off and on. Depends on my mood that day. I mean, overall I like it, but sometimes I feel weird about that dependency resolution. But otherwise, it's a neat system. It's very easy to understand. Certainly, at least in my humble opinion, you know, I would like that system better than one of those database-centric kind of package management systems. So I was really enjoying the FreeBSD experience, and I was missing it, so I decided to go ahead and put it onto a laptop. Don't know how often I'll be able to use it. I mean, at a certain point, you kind of run out of things to actually do with these different computers with different distributions on them, but I figure it'll be a good little computer to play around with. And, I mean, it's not going to do anything else. You know, I'm either going to put something on it or it's going to sit on a shelf, so I'd rather get it used until I lend it to someone else. So I went and downloaded FreeBSD 8.2, and there's a FreeBSD 9.0 as well, but it's a beta right now. As of this recording, it's a beta. Could go into a real release any moment now, I guess, but I downloaded 8.2. The installation went well enough, couple of problems with it, and I just kept thinking, okay, every time I try to install BSD, it seems like I have the same reoccurring problem, so obviously I'm not installing BSD often enough, or I'm not keeping good enough notes on the process, or a little bit of both. So I went back to the backup files from the computer that had BSD on it. So I went back and looked at all the old notes that I had taken on that whole experience, and it turns out that I took really good notes. And there was this gap between me realizing, oh yeah, I've got notes on this, and me realizing, gee, I'm having trouble with installing BSD again, there was this gap, and during that gap I went onto the internet and looked for solutions for the problems that I was having. And interestingly enough, I didn't really find answers to those problems online, but I found them in my notes. So I typed up my notes in a little bit more friendly of a format, and I'm going to review them here, and I'll probably post the actual text file, ogcastplanet.org/unstableblog. So if you're installing BSD and you start having any kind of issues, this might be some of the problems. So the first thing that I had problems with was the hard drive format. I think I had tried to install, I think it was the 9.0 beta first, and I had some problems pretty early on with the user add function. I was adding a normal user, and it didn't make a home directory for some reason, which really confused me. Not that I can't make my own home directory, I just thought it was weird that the script hadn't done it. And I looked in slash home, and I looked in slash usr slash home, and I didn't see the home folder in either place, so I was pretty confident that it hadn't generated the home folders. And I just, at that point, I thought, you know, I shouldn't be using a 9.0 beta right now. I should really just stick with stable. So went back and tried to reinstall 8.2 as a clean install, you know. But it seemed to get confused, and I'm not saying that it is BSD. It's more like it's probably something that I wasn't doing. But I got confused when I was trying to repartition the hard drives, and when I went to commit those changes, the partitioning program kept telling me that it couldn't find a valid node for my swap partition. I don't know enough about partitioning to even know really what that would mean or how I could show it where that node was. And I tried a couple of different things, and ultimately it was easier to just pop in a Fedora disk and use the Fedora partitioner, which I guess is GNU parted, to wipe that hard drive clean as one big hard drive again, and then reboot into FreeBSD 8.2 installer, and then do the automated partitioning stuff there. And then it worked. So, not really sure what the problem was. It seemed like possibly either I was telling it that I was doing some kind of repair install rather than a clean install, although I don't think I was, or the partitioning program was just getting conflicting data maybe from what I was telling it and what the hard drive was actually doing. I'm not sure, but watch out for it, and if it happens to you, don't freak out, just maybe wipe that hard drive in with some other thing first to get it completely sort of a clean slate without any partition data in it, and then have FreeBSD reset all of that for you. Another thing to be aware of when you're doing the partitioning scheme is that I'm kind of used to like CFdisk, really mostly CFdisk, but even other ones, they have you set the partitioning scheme and kind of you slice it and dice it up, and then you hit write, and it writes all that stuff to the hard drive, and then you proceed with the install. On FreeBSD, you don't do it that way. You set up your partitions and everything, and then you continue with the installation, and then when it's installing everything, that's when the partitioning changes are actually committed. So that kind of kept throwing me off too, because I kept trying to write my changes, and it kept telling me not to do that unless I was editing a current install. So there was a little bit of confusion there, born from the fact that I have not installed BSD all that often compared to the multiple times I've installed Linux. So just kind of note to self, start some VMs and just kind of practice installing BSD. It's a good thing. So package management in BSD, I mean, I think I've already talked about ports at the end of Season 5, the beginning of Season 6, and the binary packages and stuff like that. Ports is, like I say, a pretty cool system. I really like it. I feel very comfortable with it because Slack builds, from what I can tell, models itself very much after ports. So it feels really good. Like I also said, I'm not sure how I feel about the dependency resolution. I always feel like I have no clue what's getting installed on my computer whenever I go in to install something, unless I read all the files in there, which, you know, not the worst thing in the world, but I don't know, it feels like I'm not putting it there myself, or like I just know it's not being compiled the way I would have done it, you know, something silly like that. But it's a cool system, I really like it, and when you're installing FreeBSD, you need to make sure that you are installing the ports collection and that you take advantage of the binary packet. So the binary packages will come along with the full FreeBSD installer. So it'll be like a 2 gigabyte, 3 gig. No, I think it's like 2 gigabyte disk. On that disk, it's got the very minimal FreeBSD system, which takes like 10 minutes to copy from the disk to your computer. It's a very fast install. But that's because you barely got anything. So then you need to go through and install packages. And these are just binary packages that have been pre-compiled for whatever architecture you're installing. The advantage here is that it's very, very fast. If you, and believe me, I tried this earlier, it wasn't even today, it was literally yesterday because it took that long. But I was really trying to add most of the stuff that I was going to be using from ports. And this is on a somewhat older laptop. I mean, not old, but it's on a laptop that doesn't quite have the power of even my Lenovo, and certainly not of my new workstation. So this laptop is not that, and in compiling everything from ports, which compiles from source, it can take a long time. So bear that in mind, and take advantage of those binary packages that come on the DVD. But remember that you're going to go through that step. So it's going to ask you, and just because of the order, and if you're not reading carefully, you might not realize what you're doing exactly. But for me, I just chose to install everything, all the packages and all the source code, what I do on Slackware, so I figured same deal on FreeBSD. And it's just so much faster than trying to compile everything from source. But on the other hand, there are ports that you're going to want to use later on, you know, things that didn't come pre-installed as a binary, or just something that maybe you didn't need when you were installing, but you wanted it later. Well, /usr/ports is where the ports are kept as long as you installed them. I went through the FreeBSD installer twice because the first time, well, more than twice, but because the first time I failed to install the ports at all. Now, luckily, you don't have to actually reinstall the entire system just to get the ports off of that disk, and we'll go into that in a minute. But if you're sitting in the installer and you're being asked a bunch of questions, then one of those will be related to installing the ports collection. I don't know if that entirely makes sense if you're not used to the way that ports and Slack builds works, but what you're doing when you're getting ports is you're getting this skeleton tree of all the different packages that exist on servers out there in the world. And then you go into, and it's along with a list, it's got make files for each package. So you go into a division of ports, like /usr/ports/audio/audacity, and there's information on Audacity, a make file for it, and all that other good stuff, and then you tell it to make install clean, and it builds Audacity, it goes out and it fetches the actual source code for Audacity, brings it down to your computer, it makes it, it builds it and installs it, and then it cleans up after itself a little bit. And that's what's happening. So when I say to install the ports collection or the ports tree or whatever, I don't mean actually install all of the ports. It's just grab that mirror, that repository of what is available out there in the world. And then when you need it, you'll have it in /usr/ports. It's well worth it. It's located in the distributions menu selection during the installation process, just for the record. The other way to get to that step of where you pull the ports, or really even other things, but let's use that as an example, is a command, once you've installed FreeBSD, called sysinstall, S-Y-S-I-N-S-T-A-L-L, and this is, I don't know, a little bit like running package tool in Slackware and rerunning some of the install scripts or the setup scripts. So it's a little bit like that. Actually, it looks a lot like that too. It launches a little incursus interface, and you can choose post-install configuration things to rerun. And you can install, you can find again in the distributions menu the port collection, and you can tell it to install that. And it has a different, you know, if you don't have the disk anymore, you can just pull it from the internet, or if you don't have the internet right now and you do have the disk, then you can get it off the disk. So however you do it, it is there, sysinstall, that's kind of the place you can go to pick up any of the stuff that you kind of forgot to do during installation, whether it's setting the time zone or fonts or grabbing the ports collection or whatever it might be. So by now you've got BSD installed, you're sitting in front of a laptop with FreeBSD, staring in its black screen, white text, no X glory right at you. So the first thing you'll want to do is create some users. Well, unless you've done that during installation. I didn't. So you run the user add script, or add user, whichever it is. I always get the two mixed up. And it's a nice, friendly, prompt-driven, interactive thing to add users. And once that's done, you can continue with normal business, whatever that might be. Probably it's going to be a stopover by /usr/ports to install stuff. And one of that stuff might be something like, oh, I don't know, Zorg, and some kind of window management, window manager program. This all went pretty easily. I mean, it's like I say, you just cd into /usr/ports/whatever, whether it's x11 or x11-wm. Pretty direct. You make install clean as long as you've got an internet connection. It all kind of just happens. It's not a big deal. The problem came after I'd had Zorg installed and started doing things like, you know, starting X, which fairly common thing to do. So two things to remember here. First of all, there's a system-wide xinitrc file, and this is the kind of thing that you've probably had not thought about recently. I know I actually have, but normally I wouldn't. But there is a system-wide xinitrc file on the system. And of course, the xinitrc is that which tells Zorg what to do when someone types in start X. This is located in /usr/local/lib/x11/xinit/xinitrc. And if you look at it, down at the bottom of that file, you will see the default, well, I mean, the whole file will have defaults, but down at the bottom you'll find the default window manager that it launches, and in this case, it seems to be TWM. It's a very basic, ugly X11 window system. Not really fond of it myself. I'm sure a lot of people like it. Very minimal and stuff like that. I'm not a fan. It's something though. But so that's the default. That's what's going to be launched if you don't tell it to launch something else. The way that you tell it to launch something else is to place in your home directory a .xinitrc, and that is just all lowercase .xinitrc. And an xinitrc file is marvelously simple. It can contain one line if you want. Of course, you can look at their sample in usr local lib x11 xinit xinitrc if you want to see cooler things that you can do in it. But the bare minimum is one line, and that is exec space, in this case, /usr/local/kde4/bin/startkde4. And that would, whenever I type in start X, that's going to look at my home directory for a .xinitrc file. It finds one, and then it tells Zorg to execute the command of user local kde4/bin/startkde4. So in this case, kde4 would start. Very, very easy. Just not necessarily something you think of, since a lot of us are used to our window managers sort of shipping predefined with the distribution, or finding sample ones in one folder that we can then cat to our personal home folder. So I had X installed, and then when I started X, strangely enough, I lost all functionality of my keyboard and my mouse, and no combination of Zorg.conf could ever seem to work. I could get back out of X into a virtual console, strangely. I could hit Control-Alt-F1 or something and get out of X, but to actually enter text into the X environment, it just was like there was no keyboard and there was no mouse. That really confused me until I didn't really see anything online about this until I found the solution in my notes, and that was to add a couple of lines to rc.conf. So rc.conf is a lot like rc.local, or I guess really I think it's always called rc.local. But it's that last RC file that loads right before you get the boot prompt at your on your computer, the login prompt, rather, on your computer. So rc.conf is located in Etsy, so it's /etc/rc.conf. If you do a Vim or a Nano or Emacs, whatever, on that file, then you will see a couple of lines probably already entered in it for you, but the ones that you'll want to add are /hld_enable=yes, /dbus_enable=yes, and then for me I also added /local_startup=$curly brace, /local_startup\curly brace\usr/local/kde4/etc/rc.d", which simply says for the system to run the RC files embedded, if you will, into the KDE4 environment. And then KDE m4_enable=yes, which I honestly have no clue what that means, and I didn't bother looking. It was in my notes, so I entered it, and it seems to be working just fine. So anyway, whether you need the KDE stuff or not doesn't really necessarily, that's not necessarily true, but the HALD and the dbus enable you will want if you are having trouble with your mouse and keyboard in Zorg. And there's not a whole lot of mention of that anywhere. I really wonder how I found that out in the first place, but I'm glad that I did. On a related note, of course, the trackpad is never configured the way that I like. It's always tapping when I don't want it to tap, and moving when I don't want it to move, and too sensitive, not sensitive enough, whatever. Used to do all that configuration through Syn Client, and now since it's using HAL, you would want to make a HAL policy. That's done with, I'm not going to say simple XML, it's done with XML. It is, in theory, fairly simple, but you'd want to look online to find out all the different attributes that you really want your mouse, or your trackpad, rather, to have, because obviously everyone likes it different. I hate mouse tapping on. Some people swear by it. Some people want the two-finger scroll. Some people want finger down the side of the trackpad scroll. So I won't get into how that's done, especially since every time I do it, I just copy and paste either off of something offline or from an old config file of my own. And that's really about it. I mean, there are a couple of random other things that I do on really any system. I mean, it's not just the BSD, and it's got everything to do with, Xmod map. I put that into my home directory as a .xmod map file, and then I write a little script to run that file when KDE logs in, and that's simply in /.kde/autostart/, for instance, xmodmapper.sh, and that would just be telling it to run the script, you know, to run xmodmap on /.xmodmap. And then, of course, I import my global hotkeys and keyboard shortcuts and all that other stuff, but this is all KDE, not really BSD-specific. That's about all I've got for BSD. Again, great system, really, really fun to use. It's a real great time. The PCBSD distribution's really nice right now. I looked at that. I mean, I hate their configuration of KDE, but that's just personal preference, and it's obviously something that can get changed really, really easily at any moment, so not a big deal. Overall, I just think it's a really great little distribution of BSD, and I was amazed because they actually have 3D acceleration on the desktop in the Intel Mobile 4 chip, which last time I tried BSD, that wasn't working. Although it's important to note that I tried FreeBSD and it wasn't working. It's working on PCBSD, so whatever they're doing it right. They know what they're doing. So if you haven't tried that, feel free to check it out. And with that, I think it's time for a cup of coffee.
OMG, it's coffee time!
A great cup of coffee. I hope you had a really good one. The cup of coffee that I had actually has inspired me to really ponder the operating system that we use. And you'll have to pardon the philosophical segment here, but I'll start it off with a little product review because those are geeky. I do not consider myself a music client kind of person. I don't like music players, generally speaking. InPlayer from the command line is really what I use most. I was using MPD for a while, but the server actually has the sound card in my music server died, so it's not really a music server anymore. And I just, you know, if I have to use a graphical music player on a system, for instance, that doesn't have something on the command line, then I'll generally default to VLC or XMMS or Audacious, something small and simple. You simply drag whatever you want to have played onto that thing, and then you let it play, and then it stays out of your way. And that's pretty much what I've always done. But recently people have been asking me, actually a fair amount, about Linux, I guess because I'm kind of the odd man out where I am right now, using nothing but Linux in a building full of Macs. So, you know, people have been curious about it, and I've gotten some questions recently, probably because I never hide my disdain over iTunes and the way that it mismanages everything. I get some questions about the music players in Linux, and I always would default to VLC because that's the music player that's available on everything, and it's, I think, a pretty good and stellar example of a Linux app. You know, if you want someone's first impression to be of Linux to be something really good and powerful, VLC in a multimedia production house is probably a pretty good thing to reference, in addition to, obviously, Firefox. So that's kind of what I was defaulting to, but some people were more interested in a proper music-playing application. When I say some people, I mean one person, but she was interested in a music-playing application. I mean, not that she's actually going to sit down and use Linux, but they were, you know, it was conversation. They wanted to see something that played music. And so, in the time that was kind of leading up to this presentation of a music-playing application, I was really kind of desperately poking around for a good music player. I was setting up a Fedora server, and I needed something just to play some music while I was setting up the server. Could have done InPlayer, could have done FFmpeg, could have done something like that. But I decided, well, why not try a music-playing application? So I tried Exaile, E-X-A-I-L-E, I think, and it's actually really nice. It's really quite nice. It doesn't grab control of the music away from you. It just lets you manage it and do it the way that you want to, whether it's by files or by ID3 tags or whatever. And, of course, I always opt for files. And so that was pretty cool. But it's a GTK app. And not that that matters, but I mean, I'm just saying it's an app that I don't really have avail, you know, on my system usually. It was just something that was quick and easy to install on that one Fedora server so that I could listen to some music. And been wanting to try Amarok for a while, just kind of curious about it. I always knew that it was a very popular application. I knew that it was a very popular music playing application among lots of different ones, and I met the lead maintainer, the lead developer of Amarok at the KDE release event a long time ago. Was really impressed by him, and I enjoy the Amarok reputation, so I wanted to try it for myself, and this was a perfect excuse because people were asking me about a real music player. And so I open up Amarok on my Slackware system, and I look at it, and I can't even comprehend what I'm seeing. I mean, the layout is just, it's very good, I'm sure, but it's just not my style. And I thought, well, you know what, so that's the negative reaction. The positive was that it's a beautiful application. It's just it's really, really nice looking. It's got nice buttons, it's got nice panels, you know, it's well put together, if that makes any sense. It probably doesn't, but to me, it just looked like a good app. So I thought, well, This is cute. I can, and I mean cute as in QT. This is cute. I can make this work for me, for my style of working. And so I rearranged some of the panels and did some stuff and kind of played around with it. And the more I started playing around with it, the more I realized it is a really nice application. And it's kind of nice because it sits up there in your little taskbar or whatever. And you can always go back up to it, or you can use keyboard shortcuts to control it. And it's just kind of its own little local host MPD almost, if you will. And it was really, really nice. And I put it away at the end of the day, and I came back in the next day and found myself opening it back up almost without even thinking about it. You know, it was kind of addictive in a very subtle kind of, this is a nice application. So, Amarok, very cool application, very solid application, very flexible application, and that's the kind of operating system that you and I, dear listener, have chosen to use. Why am I saying this? This is something that happened to me. I was at a cafe the other day. I was working on an article for a magazine that I'd been commissioned to write. Lots of fun. Loved it. But as I was writing this article, I kept finding myself, and it would sneak up on me, I kept finding myself sort of apologizing to the mythical user who was reading this article in the future for the different applications that they had to use on Linux. I wasn't literally apologizing. I wasn't writing, "Dear reader, I am very sorry that you have to use OpenOffice instead of whatever, or Amarok instead of iTunes, or whatever." But mentally speaking, I could tell that I was apologetic, or I was shy to introduce these new applications. And then I stopped, of course. I stopped that, and I started writing a little bit more pragmatically. But it really made me think, and it made me think about who, by what standards we're basing what applications are supposed to be like. And I realized that we are all pretty new to computers. I mean, more or less. It's a fairly new technology. Nothing's been around long enough, really, to say that this is the absolute right way of doing anything. And of course the old argument is that actually Unix has been around the longest of all, so, you know, I mean, these are new things, and it just so happens that we all got schooled in the office, or in school, or by our parents, or by our brothers or sisters, whatever. We got taught to use a certain set of applications, and a lot of them are very, very common applications. You know, they're the same, it's the same Office application, the same graphic application. There are variations. You'll find people who swear by Corel or by Lotus, I guess, or Word Star or whatever it's called, Word Perfect. So, you know, you find minor variations here and there, but by and large, we can say that they're basically the same set. But what does that mean? All it means is that these sort of run-of-the-mill applications that everyone just kind of knows, they got popular by chance, really. You know, they rode that wave of being in the right place at the right time and being good enough and being the only game in town and for long enough. You know, all these factors kind of start to weigh in and people start to learn them. Some school system or government invests in it and then suddenly we're all learning it, or you go to a company and that's what they're using, so you learn it. But there's no one in this world that is actually saying that all photo imaging software must be like Photoshop, or they must be equated to Photoshop, or they must do everything the same way that Photoshop does, or that all Office applications must be exactly like Microsoft Office, or that they must be compared to Microsoft Office, or that all music apps should be like, you know which music app I'm thinking of, and I'm not even going to say the name of because I can't stand how it works. And even to think about emulating it makes me uncomfortable. So there's nothing out there saying that a Linux or Unixy app should be like anything else. And the minute that I fire up Emacs and have to tell someone how to do a save with Control X and a Control S, yes, two keyboard shortcuts for one action, believe it or not, I know it's crazy, or Vim, yes, you have to hit the escape key to get into a command mode, and then you have to get into the insert mode with the I key. Radically different ideas. You know, these are text editors that require a different set of working habits, a completely different way of doing something. I mean, those are, honestly, simple though they may be, those probably two of the most drastically different things that Unix has to offer. You know, it's like a text editor that has two different modes, or that has a set of keyboard shortcuts to get you into different buffers or different different things, either a command or to run an extension or a plugin, whatever they call them in Emacs. Yes, these are cool things. These are different, and I'm sorry that it's not like text edit or Notepad or Office. And actually, I'm not sorry. It's just they're not like that, because no one said that Notepad or text edit or Microsoft Office or Photoshop was right, that no one said that those had to be the way that things were. In fact, for all I know, Notepad and Microsoft Office and Photoshop are doing it wrong. They are doing it wrong, and GIMP and LibreOffice and Emacs, these are doing it the right way. I don't know, I would think that I would be my own poster child for that concept already. You know, I mean, I was certified in Photoshop, I was certified in Final Cut Pro, I went to school for some of these things. You'd think that I would, having dropped them both for GIMP and Blender at the time, thankfully KDN Live now, you'd think I would understand that the free software doesn't need to emulate the non-free, because I just went cold turkey, basically. But I think that there's still that sensitivity there, because there's always that sort of apologetic, public-facing version, you know, the one that wants the person to come smoothly into this OS and not have any bumps or wrinkles when they're trying out the application that they're trying. Well, I'm sorry if they started out on Microsoft or Mac. Most of us did at this point. Right now, most of us started out using Microsoft and Mac-based computer systems. So we're all going to have those little bumps and wrinkles getting into Linux. And there's no way to avoid that, you know. And if we had all grown up on Linux and were for some ungodly reason going over to Windows, there'd be bumps and wrinkles, actually quite large bumps and quite wrinkly wrinkles in that transition. That's what a transition is. There's a little bit of turbulence when you're doing that. And the funnier thing is, I think, that even the people who are using Linux around me, all like one, sometimes two of them, even these people, when they're sort of, as they are transitioning, or as they are taking a break from their proprietary OS and using the free one, actually three or four people now, but if you look at them using their OS that they're quote-unquote used to, they actually have just as many complaints about it as they do when they're using Linux. It's really funny. It's just a different set of problems. They may know where the button to do something is on Mac, but it's not working the way it's supposed to work. Or they don't know how to do something on Mac, and they never really had to do it anyway, but suddenly they have to, and they don't know how to, so they get angry at it. Or they used to know, but then Mac changed it, so they get angry about that. Put them on Linux, they're still complaining about how they don't know how to do something. It's just a new set of complaints. And at least for me, I think there's a heightened sensitivity there, so that when they're complaining about Linux, I take it a little bit more personally, whereas when they're complaining about Mac, I just kind of sit there and smugly chuckle and pat my belly and think, ha ha, look at them and their non-free OS struggling. But there's still the complaints either way. It's just a question of whether you see it and whether you're taking it more personally than you should, and what you're going to do about it if it's a proprietary complaint. You know, it might be a perfect time to point out the alternatives, or the fact that if it was free, it would be a lot more flexible than the proprietary one, and you could just kind of change things around for yourself and make it work better for you, a la Amarok and myself, or KDE and myself. And in any case, we should never accept, as Linux users, we should never accept that our computer environment is playing catch-up to the non-free world. It is playing catch-up if there is a feature that one person needs that you know, a person that you know needs a feature that Linux, that this Linux app does not have. Then in that sense, yes, we want to provide for people, right? We all have that sort of, that desire, I think, or a lot of us do, especially promoting our little operating system that we like so much. You know, we want it to fill everyone's needs, so we want to catch up to something. But we're not catching up, we're just filling this gap that we hadn't needed before, but now someone needs. So we all hurry to try to get that to be filled. But this isn't a land rush. Microsoft and Mac didn't rush in and stake flags in their territory and say that they own computing now. They own the computing landscape. They define it. We don't have to care about what everyone thought the world looked like before. It's a new world now. We've got Linux. We've got BSD. We've got desktop Unix. You can use it. You can use it on your mobile phone. You can use it on your tablet. Why you'd want a tablet or a mobile phone, I don't know. But anyway, you could do that. And it's here, and it is different, and that's okay. We don't need to apologize for it or feel guilty about it or feel like it needs to change itself in order to fit someone else's mold. And if anyone's going to be playing catch-up, it's the people who don't know how to use Linux yet. They're going to need to catch up to us and figure out these new applications, because these new applications are progressing, they're great, and they're free in every sense of the word. In listener feedback, so I'll go over some of the listener feedback that I've gotten, although it dates back a long time, so I'm probably not going to get really to it all, but I think I've more or less replied to everyone who has emailed me personally. I certainly always try to. So Tim emailed me, and he points out in regards to, I think, two episodes ago, about the virtualization stuff. He says that actually he used to work in IT and was always surprised at how many people thought it was a recent invention, this virtualization thing, as frankly I had. That's me speaking, Clat2. Tim, again, says that he remembers working in a mainframe system quite a while ago that IBM had developed, and it actually is older. I mean, virtualization itself is actually older than Unix. This IBM virtual thing, the mainframe thing, had been invented back in the 60s. Now that he says this, I actually remember Mad Dog was talking to me, and I think maybe Cobra 2, possibly, and maybe Broem. He was kind of talking about that very thing, so I guess I just didn't think of it as being the same thing, but after Tim had emailed me, I kind of started digging around, and yeah, I remember that virtualization has been around, but I guess it's just not exactly, it doesn't feel the same to me. But then again, how can you say that when I never really used the old virtualization? So I don't know, I guess it just feels new because it's new to me. But yeah, very good information there, Tim, thank you. Mocha emailed me, M-O-C-H-A, great name actually, about a Gopher site question. Unfortunately, I'm not really the person to ask about Gopher questions. I did not personally set up the Gopher, I think it's PyGopherD is the little Gopher server that Deep Geek has running on the Information Underground server that he and I and Lost in Bronx and Skirlet are sharing. It's a virtual private server. You can hear all about it on the Information Underground Speaks cast. And we talk about the little cloud that we built and the advantages of it and sort of some of the things that go into it. Not so much about the Gopher side of things, like at least not the technical side of it. But it is cool. I was playing around on the Gopher server again today, And I'm of two minds of Gopher, I guess, because on one hand it's really easy to use, right? You take some text files, you put it into a folder, you make a little Gopher map, and you're done. And it's a really, really nice and efficient way to browse the web. When it doesn't become efficient is when it's a normal person, or maybe even you, out of your element, and you're on some kind of device that has no Gopher support, and suddenly it becomes very, very inconvenient. And I think it was in a couple of those times that it became particularly off-putting to me. I thought, well, Gopher might be neat, and it might be really easy, and all of this stuff, but any system that, you know, when you need it in a pinch and it's suddenly not there, that to me is actually quite the deal breaker. So placing important information, or important that, you know, information that you consider very, very good to have at any given time on a Gopher server, you better have a device that speaks Gopher. And you think, what's the big deal there? Surely there's a Gopher client for this and that and this and that. But is every device you have to access this stuff going to be something that you can install a Gopher client on when you need it? It's not necessarily the case. So, I guess that's the thing about Gopher that I don't necessarily love, which, you know, I mean, that's, in a way, that's not really that, it's not really fair to say that, to take that away from Gopher. You know, just because it's an ignored technology doesn't mean that it's not a good technology. And I agree with myself. Gopher is a cool technology. I do like it. I'm just saying that I think I have to kind of use it carefully, because if I put stuff on there that I really, really care about and want as a reference, I might end up not being able to access it later on. And it is something that you can kind of emulate. I mean, throw some text files online and link to them in an index.html page, and you sort of have the same thing. Not necessarily the exact same, but it's very, very similar. So, to some degree, it's cool technology that kind of got replaced pretty solidly by HTTP and that sort of thing. So, I don't know. I like it. I like it a lot. I tend to use it sparingly, simply because I really like cross-platform stuff that works on all kinds of different devices. Rex DeGier from the Across Ad Ogcast wrote me, or actually he forwarded me, sort of, but it's a really cool mailing list post. Some guy, I guess Craig is the guy's name, is thinking about trying to come out with this plugin for Audacity that would tie into Ekiga, which is, of course, the little SIP client or whatever that comes with some version of GNOME, although I don't think that it comes with the new one. I think they're using Telepathy now or something. But anyway, yeah, so it's Ekiga, and they want to do kind of a plug-in that will have just a switch in Audacity that says, yes, record this. I think that's a great idea, although actually a guy on IRC, Saras Fox, had me try Mumble finally. People have been trying to get me to try it for a long time, and I just never really had the computer and the bandwidth at the same time to actually make that happen, much less a USB headset. But now I'm in a much better place, and so I decided to go ahead and try it, and I have to say I'm just floored. I'm just amazed by Mumble. I feel like remote calling and recording is basically solved with Mumble, really. The only thing that you need with Mumble are servers that you can sign into, but so far the community seems to be providing that pretty well, so Mumble is really, really cool as everyone says it is. Christian emailed me to, well, first of all, say that he or she really enjoyed the 13.37 episode of GNU World Order, which, of course, I was talking about Slackware a lot, and I have to agree with Christian. The the tool set for Slackware in terms of the packaging and stuff is just amazing. I know it's not for everyone, I guess it's not for everyone, because some people says they say it's not, so I have to believe them. But for me and other people, it's a beautiful, beautiful system. So if you have not tried Slackware, you should try it. Random person from London is also encouraging you to do so. Christian also told me about GNU Parallel, which I'd actually kind of heard from Integral on IRC. I think it was him. He mentioned GNU Parallel. And it's a tool that you can, well, that it lets you run jobs in parallel. I haven't really played around with it yet, and when I first heard about it, I didn't even understand how that was any different than opening two terminals and simply issuing a command on different things, you know, twice. I still don't know exactly what GNU Parallel is, or the technical advantages of it, or whatever. I tried a couple of things with it. It seems pretty cool. I really kind of want to get to know it even more. I want to do more stuff with it and really, really be impressed, you know, like really get excited about it and understand why exactly it's so cool. But I mean, heck, anything having to do with I don't know if it's technically multi-threading, but you know, that kind of thing, that's got to be good. I mean, I love that. I've always thought and been puzzled by how much power there is in a computer, and yet how it seems like there's always these little bottlenecks, you know, these points in that system where no matter how much power you've got, everything's got to wait its turn. So, yeah, so finally, last but not least, Paul Outbox. That's the guy's name. The guy who gave me the Hawaiian coffee, Paul Outbox. I don't think Outbox is his real last name, but his first name may very well be Paul. And he sent me the Hawaiian coffee. He introduced himself to me at Self. I just completely forgot his name, could not remember. But luckily, he is, I guess, a fairly regular listener, because he poked me and said, Paul is my name. And so, yes, it is Paul. And thank you, Paul, for the coffee. I think that's about it. I mean, there were other emails, but some of them date so far back at this point that it would be almost just kind of weird to try to answer them now. So, there you go. That's the long and short of it. That's the show. Hopefully you enjoyed the show, and of course I'll be back next time with episode 17. This has been the GNU World Order, episode 16. I'm Klaatu, and you can reach me online at notklaatu@jabber.org for IM. You can find me as notklaatu on the Freenode IRC network in #podcastplanet, #slackermedia, #slackware, #openmolar, lots of different places. Email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org, or klaatu@hackpublicradio.org, or klaatu@straightedgelinux.com. It all goes to the same place. And of course, the website is ogcastplanet.org/GNU World Order. Hey, and be sure to check the ogcastplanet.org/unstable blog for interesting and entertaining blog entries from me and lots of other people, like Deep Geek and Code Cruncher and Code Master and Code Karate Chopper.
Anarcho-syndicalist communist.